For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right. So one of the things that I want to talk about here is just really the concept that God wants us to enter into the world and to share the message of Christ in a way that fits within the context of the culture that we're reaching. And I think probably the best starting point for this would be to look at Paul's example. Really, he put forward some of the examples that we look to in trying to reach people effectively for Christ. Maybe one of the best passages that Paul wrote on this would be from 1 Corinthians 9, verse 19 and 20, where he says, "Though I am free and belong to no man, I make myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. To the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, I became like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so as to win those under the law." So you can see that Paul was very conscientious to share the message of Christ in a way that was not offensive. After all, he was a Jewish man, grew up in the faith, but also was a Pharisee. So he was really among the religious elite of the Jewish community. And so he understood the Jewish customs as he tried to share the message of Christ with them. And so one of the things that we see from Paul is that, you know, he showed cultural sensitivity as he shared the message of Christ. And I think, like Paul, believers also need to show cultural sensitivity as we try to share Christ with our culture. And so there are certain things that will create noise, that will create barriers to people hearing the gospel. You know, you can imagine if you didn't really understand Jewish or Muslim culture, you know, if you're sitting there trying to share the message of Christ with somebody from that background, and, you know, you're sitting there eating a pulled pork sandwich, that's gonna create some noise there that maybe you didn't intend. And yet, we want to make sure that as we share the message of Christ, that it comes through clearly without any of those barriers. He goes on in 1 Corinthians 9, verse 21 and 22 to say, "To those not having the law, I became like one not having the law, though I am not free from God's law, but am under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. To the weak, I became like the weak to win the weak, and I have become all things to all men, so that by all possible means I might win some." So you can see Paul's mentality here. He's ever crafting his approach based on the people he's reaching in order to effectively share the message of Christ in a way that will connect with the people he speaks to. And, you know, I think that Paul's example here stands in stark contrast to what you might call the faithful sowing theology. And under the faithful sowing theology, the only thing that really matters is that we proclaim the word of Christ, either by our words or through our deeds, whether people hear it or not. And so what really matters is that we sow abundantly. Whether that actually takes root and people actually come to Christ, that's none of our business. That doesn't really matter. Our job is to be faithful. And although I think that captures part of what we see in the Bible, I don't think it adequately fits with what we see in Scripture. You know, Donald McGavern, who's an expert in missiology, points out that this theology grew up at a time when the church was growing incrementally and had to come up with a theology to try to figure out why the church wasn't growing and to justify its existence. And so what the church developed was a theology that focused primarily on faithfulness at the expense of results. And yet, when we look at Scripture, God extols faithfulness, but he's also interested in seeing results, actually seeing people come to Christ, actually interested in seeing the church grow. Jesus' parables often emphasize finding the lost, not just searching for people who are lost, Think about Luke chapter 15. You know, the woman who's searching for the lost coin, the story doesn't end with her just endlessly searching. The story ends with her finding the coin and expressing great joy and gratitude that she found what was lost. Same with the shepherd in the 99, where he left the 99 in search of the one. But again, the story doesn't end there. He rejoices when he finds the lost sheep. So these parables really capture the idea that God cares about the lost, that the process of searching for those who are lost, our faithfulness, those things matter. But God also shows a lot of interest in seeing people actually won to Christ, to have the lost found. After all, Jesus concludes in his parable in Luke 15, verse 5 and 6, when he finds it, he joyfully puts it onto his shoulders and goes home. Then he calls his friends and neighbors together and says, "Rejoice with me, I found my lost sheep." I tell you that in the same way, there will be more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who do not need to repent. So the emphasis here isn't just about the lost, it's about what's found. And I think that's very important for us to recapture, especially as we're reaching a culture that grows increasingly hardened to the message of Christ and shows maybe less and less interest in spiritual things. Now, we should qualify this by saying that there are cases where Jesus walked into a city, for example, a Samaritan city, and the people didn't welcome him there. Or think about when he sent out the 70 disciples and he said, "What I want you to do is, if people don't welcome you or they're not willing to listen to what you have to say, I want you to walk to the edge of the city and shake off your cloak," indicating that the judgment of God stands upon this city. And Paul experienced this as well when he went to Pisidian Antioch and met a lot of persecution. What did he do? He went to the edge of the city. He shook the dust off of his cloak as a sign of judgment upon that city. So what I'm suggesting here is that faithfulness matters. And in many cases, we will meet resistance. We will meet people who are unwilling to listen to the message of Christ. But we shouldn't throw away the desire to see real results, to see people won to Christ. And you see this really in Paul's mentality, that he is willing to constantly change himself in a superficial way, not changing his values, not changing his theology, but adapting to the culture in which he's reaching in order to get a hearing from his crowd. You know, Paul was constantly foraging for culturally relevant ways to introduce the message of Christ. I think one of the greatest examples of this comes from Acts chapter 17. Paul is faced with speaking in front of the intellectual elite of the world at this time, in Western culture. He's going to speak at the Areopagus, where the latest fads of intellectual thinking were circulating. And Paul, speaking at the Areopagus in front of these men at Athens, says, "I see that in every way you are very religious, for as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar to this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' Now, what you worshiped as something unknown, I'm going to proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth." This allusion that he makes to the altar containing the inscription "to an unknown God" actually is well documented in Diogenes, the lives of the eminent philosophers, written in around the 3rd century AD. Diogenes describes this event that took place around 500 BC, where the city of Athens encountered this plague that was decimating the city. And the elders were so desperate to find a solution that they decided to call upon the Cretan poet Epimenides, who was known to be a wise man. So he traveled all the way from Crete to Athens, and they consulted with him as they were standing on Mars Hill. And Epimenides suggested, "Okay, have you guys sacrificed to all the gods in Athens?" And they said, "Yes, we have." And still, there have been no results. The plague hasn't been lifted. And so Epimenides reasoned to himself that there must have been an unknown god greater than all the other gods in Athens who was able to deliver the city. And so he came up with this plan. He said, what I want you to do is I want you to take a flock of sheep. And what I want you to do is I want you to make sure that they don't forage for 2 or 3 days. Then on the specified day, I want you to get your best stonemasons along with these sheep. And what we're going to do is we're going to set these sheep out along Mars Hill. And the ones that don't pasture, the ones that don't eat any of the greenery, and the ones that actually lay down, that's where we need to build our altar. And so as the story goes, they let these sheep loose, and a small segment, 3 or 4 of them, sat down in the grass, and they weren't eating any of the vegetation. And Epimenides says, that's where we need to sacrifice to this unknown god. And so they built an altar, sacrificed to that god, and as legend had it, the plague lifted. And so Paul, knowing and understanding the culture he was speaking to, found a reference point to connect with his audience. And really, in the same way, we need to think about ways that we can understand the culture in which we're reaching, find ways to connect with our culture using things like music, art, maybe TV series that we see, in order to be able to discuss really underlying worldviews that drive the things that we see in our culture. Later on in Paul's talk at the Areopagus, he says, for in him we live and move and have our being, as some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. Again, he's quoting another poet, Aratus, who is from the 3rd century BC. And so, again, you can see how adept Paul was as he was sharing Christ, that he knew his audience, he knew their culture, he knew their literature, and was able to speak in a way that was relevant to them. And really, what we see here is an example of contextualization, which is, you know, just like a $15 word describing how we as believers are able to bring the message of Christ in a way that fits with the culture that we're trying to reach. You know, I think when it comes to contextualization, the Christian worldview doesn't seek to overtake culture. It's compatible with culture. You know, contrary to what some political parties will tell you, you know, the church was never really intended to take over the government or to legislate Christian morals upon our society. You know, one of the really beautiful things about Christianity is that it can coexist with any culture, that it doesn't seek to overtake that culture, but it can live really in balance with that culture. Secondly, Christians tend to be very insular and anti-cultural. There's a history of this as you study church history, where over time the church will adapt in a way that really fits with the culture and resonates with the culture. But there is also this unwillingness to change over time. And so that's why you see in different denominations practices that were relevant maybe 100 or 200 or even 1,000 years ago. It was effective in reaching those people, but really have grown irrelevant today. And so one of the things that we need to do as we continue to try and reach people effectively in our culture is that we need to make sure that we are staying relevant culturally, not trying to protect ourselves from the evil that we feel like is encroaching upon the church. Thirdly, we need to adapt to culture without adopting its worldview and its values. So we're not talking about cultural accommodation, where we start to morph and shift our theology to make it more pleasant, or some, you know, make it palatable for non-Christian people. That's not what we're talking about here. You know, we need to adapt to our culture, while at the same time teaching our people to critique the values, really, and the worldview driving our culture. You know, you think about Hudson Taylor, really the pioneer of modern contextualization. He was a missionary who went to China. And unlike his contemporaries, which, you know, often what they would do is they would enter a culture, they would reach a few people for Christ, and then they would Europeanize those people, making them wear Western dress, getting them to learn a European language, and to take on European worship forms. Hudson Taylor decided that he was going to become like the people he was reaching, just like Paul. And so it's interesting, in many superficial ways, you know, Hudson Taylor took on the appearance of a Chinese man, dressing like a Chinese man, shaping his beard into, I guess, you know, a Chinese man from a couple hundred years ago. He learned Chinese. And so, you know, you can imagine the impact this must have had on Chinese people as they saw this guy who appeared to be a Chinese impersonator. And they start talking to him and he speaks perfect, fluent Chinese. That would probably give, you know, him a hearing in a way that others would not. I also think that this doesn't mean that we uncritically ape our culture, adopting its worldview and values. You know, we've seen how the emerging church movement swept across the United States and really ripped away large swaths of the American evangelical church. Tens of thousands of people losing their faith as a result of postmodern theology. And so we're not suggesting that we become like our culture in all ways, but that we become like our culture in superficial ways. That the average non-Christian person will look at us and think, this person looks like a normal person, acts like a normal person. And yet there's something about them that really stands out as different about them. And I can't quite put my finger on it. That's really, I think, the kind of vibe, the sort of ethos that we want to put forth. Also, we need to consume media, literature, and art with a critical eye, seeking ways to understand the world views that drive our culture. I think today what I see is that Christians are largely focused on the behavior that they see, which they find to be immoral or detestable. You know, there's a critique about the growing and really wholehearted acceptance of homosexuality in our culture, or the growing acceptance of recreational marijuana. And yet what I think Christians are failing to see is what is the underlying worldview that drive some of these features in culture that we see. Often the behavior is related to the underlying worldview that drives those behaviors. And so I think we need to look a little deeper, to think more critically about our culture and what worldview underlies the drives and desires that we see people have. You know, 50 years ago, Francis Schaeffer wrote The God Who Is There. And I remember reading this book about 20 years ago as a brand new Christian, and it just struck me how Francis Schaeffer, speaking in the 1960s, was describing things that seemed to be happening at that time. Indeed, he was a prophet of his day. And the reason he was so effective in predicting what would happen, you know, 20 years later, was that he had really a heartbeat of the culture. He understood the pulse of the culture in a way that many others didn't. And for me, as a brand new Christian, that made a huge impression, that one of the things that you do if you want to be an effective Christian worker is that you need to understand culture. You need to understand your culture better than your culture understands itself. And I remember this diagram, the staircase diagram. just always stuck with me, where he proposed that the church has always been last to adopt the worldview of its culture. It's always been, you know, 5 or 6 steps behind the newest trend in cultural thinking. And so what he proposed was that Christians really think about philosophy, art, music, before it gets to general culture, because by that time, the church is ready to gulp that down. He says, theology has always been last for a long time. It's curious to me in studying this whole cultural drift that so many pick up the latest theological fashion and hail it as something new. But in fact, what the new theology is now saying has already been said in previously in each of the other disciplines. Think about the emerging church movement, which, you know, really gained a lot of popularity in the early to mid-2000s. Postmodernism has been around since really the 80s and 90s. I mean, people were talking about that and thinking about that, and even really earlier than that. And so the church has always been kind of on the back foot. He points out the Christian is to resist the spirit of the world, but we must understand that the world's spirit does not always take the same form. So the Christian must resist the spirit of the world in the form it takes in his own generation. If he does not do this, he is not resisting the spirit of the world at all. In other words, the Christian constantly needs to learn about his or her culture, critically evaluating what they hear. He says, those standing in the stream of historic Christianity have been especially slow to understand the relationships between various areas of thought. Do we Christians understand this shift in the contemporary world? If we do not understand it, then we are largely talking to ourselves. Think about some of the insular Christian culture that you've encountered, where there is, you know, a Christian subculture, where there's language that you use that's very specifically Christian. Music that only Christians listen to. And the question is, when you create your own culture, you detach yourself from popular or general culture. And when once that happens, you find yourself largely irrelevant to the culture in which you're trying to reach. Well, let's go through this. I think one difference I see today is that really, the scientists have sort of overtaken the philosophers. You know, people today aren't really reading that much philosophy. Instead, it seems like the scientists are the ones calling the tune. For example, I think, you know, you think about Stephen Hawking in his work, The Grand Design. He said, traditionally, these questions of philosophy, such as, how did the universe get here? Why are we here? He says these questions were traditionally for philosophy, but philosophy is dead. It has not kept up with modern developments in science, particularly in physics. As a result, scientists have become the bearers of the torch of discovery in our quest for knowledge. Really, what he's representing here is the view that you might call scientism, which is that the only way to obtain objective truth is through science. And yet, it's really interesting when you sort of parse out his statement and think about it critically. Is this statement a scientific statement? No. His statement really strikes me as a philosophical statement, not a scientific one. To be more precise, it's a metaphysical statement about science. Along the same vein, John Lennox says, what destroys scientism completely is the fatal flaw of self-contradiction that really runs throughout it. Scientism does not need to be refuted by external argument. It self-destructs. For the statement that only science can lead to truth is not itself deduced from science. It's not a scientific statement, but rather a statement about science. Therefore, if scientism's basic principle is true, the statement expressing scientism must be false. Scientism refutes itself. Hence, it is incoherent. Pretty good. I have to agree. Well, I think the other point that we should make here is that we exercise a certain amount of faith really in every area of life, including science. And that might seem like a foreign concept to somebody who is involved in the world of science, to think that you would apply faith to scientific endeavor or research. It seems really foolish. And yet, we apply faith really in every area of life. You know, you sat down, you chose to sit down in the chair that you're sitting in right now. You know, you looked at it probably, saw that it looks structurally okay. You probably assumed that there are hundreds of people who sat in that same chair over the last couple of years, and you're probably correct. But when you decided to sit down in that chair, there was an element of faith that you were exercising at that point. And so take that, you know, take, for example, something like the inverse law square of gravitation, right? It helps you predict astronomical events such as eclipses. We have observed that law works. And yet, there's also a presupposition that what has worked in the past will again work in the future. And so even in the realm of science, there's an element of faith to it as well, that it will always hold, or it holds in all cases. Secondly, an increasing number of young people either claim to be atheists or agnostic. I think this is very interesting. Over the last 7 years, the number of young people who claim to be atheists have actually jumped, doubled, from about 3% to 7%. And so it's interesting, as I've encountered more and more young people, many of them claim to be agnostic or atheist. Also, I noticed too that there's really this uncertainty in life that really gives way to despair and hopelessness. A lot of the young people that I've encountered, you know, have seen their parents lose their job, have to move out of their house because of the Great Recession of 2008 and 2009. They're constantly living under the threat of a mass school shooting or a terrorist threat. And so there's this sense that life is uncertain, and that the most important thing that you need to do is to live your life right now and to experience it to the fullest, because the future is uncertain. You know, many people today in our culture construct meaning through experiences and the mundane. You know, if I can just keep my head down and focus on what I'm doing right now, whether that's obtaining a certain degree or getting that promotion or this really obscure hobby that I'm obsessing over, that's what's going to give my life meaning, or at least it's going to shield me from the larger questions that maybe I might ask myself, such as, why does my life even matter? Does it contain any real significance? I remember talking to a high school student a couple years ago, and he was really sharp. He claimed to be an atheist. And, you know, we got into a number of really intense philosophical and spiritual conversations. And you could tell he was really well-read. He was just constantly looking through all the, you know, atheist Reddit posts. And so he had tons of arguments that he was launching during our conversation. And finally, I brought it to, why do you think your life matters? You know, if atheism is correct, God doesn't exist, and we're just really a bag of biological material sloshing around on earth, then what gives your life real significance, meaning? And he said, well, I guess just whatever I'm experiencing right now, in the moment, that's what gives my life meaning and significance. And I said, well, that's interesting, because that sounds exactly like what an existential philosopher would say. He said, I've never heard of that before. And I said, well, you should look it up. I think it would match your experience. So the next week, he shows up to our home church again, and he said, remember when you mentioned those existential philosophers? I was like, yeah. He's like, I was reading this guy named Jean-Paul Sartre. You ever heard of him? And I'm like, yeah. He's like, yeah, what he said, that's what I believe. And I think to a large extent, you know, the people that I've encountered, especially younger people, although they may not be able to articulate it in the same way, there is this sense that my life really contains no meaning. There's uncertainty at the very least about it. And so what matters is taking the mundane, taking the common, or taking experiences and trying to formulate some significance in life through those things. Secondly, when you look at art, you can see a lot of this sort of nihilism, or really, I think this kind of existential thought really coming through art. I did a lot of study in my undergraduate of art history. I find it fascinating, in large part because, you know, artists are very intelligent people. They're trying to communicate something visually in most cases. You know, for example, this one Chinese artist, his name is Tsai, and he is very interesting because he creates these ephemeral images using gunpowder. And what he'll do is he'll lay out a canvas and lay out through gunpowder these images, and through a controlled way will burn them, leaving things like this. And, you know, he points out that his interest in gunpowder comes from the region of China where he grew up. And he points out that those who originated or discovered gunpowder, that they were those who actually were looking for an elixir to make themselves immortal, which I found that to be kind of interesting. That he, you know, it's almost taking something that's commonplace and trying to elevate it to something significant. And so when you look at Tsai, you know, a lot of his work is performance because it's a one-off thing, non-repeatable. And really his crowning achievement was what he called the sky ladder. And he attempted to do this several times over 20 years, where what he did was he strung together explosives on a ladder that reached 1,600 feet into the air, held aloft by a balloon. And the concept behind this was that essentially it was man making contact with the eternal. Of course, he, from what I can tell, he's not a believer. He's agnostic. What I found to be very fascinating was that when he finally accomplished this, he was surrounded by a handful of friends and family members. And so here was this incredible life achievement that he accomplished, and yet nobody there to see it. And for him, it was the experience. It was seeing it, accomplishing it, that made it significant. Not to mention, he was taking something as commonplace as gunpowder and elevating it into something containing great meaning. Joan Cornea, who is a Spanish cartoonist, often creates a lot of cartoons that are very cynical and kind of dark, as you can see. This one's called Selfie. And he points out that with his work, it really isn't an expression of his own cynicism. He says, although my sense of humor has always been really black and absurd, I think my work reflects the cynicism of real life, not mine. And so what he's doing is he's trying to capture visually what he sees really in his culture, in our world. Here's another one from Ron Muick entitled Mask 2. It's this large sculpture of a face, expressionless, sort of suspended between sleep and death. And the art critic Kelly Grovier says, the title appears to comment upon a superficial culture of discarded personas and disposable selves. You know, I think it's really, really interesting because, you know, we live in a culture today where people feel as if they can craft and create their own identity, either based on curating their social media presence or by, you know, creating meaning or a sense of identity based on experiences that they collect. Music. Okay, when we talk about music, I'm sure that, you know, there are plenty of genres, and it's really hard to isolate one and say, well, this sort of captures what most people are thinking. But, you know, let's say you just take one genre, maybe a more obscure one, like, I don't know, mumble rap, right? That's what I'm surrounded by. Martin Sismar, who is a music critic, says that mumble rap is simplistic with subdued beats, often with snippets of strings and sometimes complemented with emo chords paired with lyrics that ping-pong between braggadocio and nihilism, with lots of sex and odes to heavy narcotics. If you've ever listened to mumble rap, I mean, that's a pretty good description of it. And so one of the things that you sense when you listen to this music, and you don't need to listen carefully to the lyrics because it's often hard to understand, but the vibe that you get as you listen to this music is that life doesn't matter. Life is going to end soon. What matters is living for now and experiencing as much as you possibly can. Adam Peor Evans, another music critic, says, mumble rap is a negotiation that offers relief from the invisible acceleration of life. It is creativity born out of boredom. You know, it's really a respite from this feeling that life is just accelerating forward. What about in general culture? You know, many, I think, today grasp for meaning and significance as they collect experiences. Documenting that in their skin through ink, or, you know, putting forward these experiences on social media and crafting a sense of identity that way. And, you know, I think when you look at a lot of general culture today, there is this sense of nihilism really that pervades our culture. One of the famous, you know, music artists, The Weeknd. If you ever listen to some of his stuff, it's really dark, kind of depressing. Simon Reynolds, another music critic, wrote this article called "Music for the Stilted Generation: The Weeknd's Deconstruction of Modern Life." And he points out that when you listen to The Weeknd's music, it really captures kind of the ethos of our world, our culture. He says, it's hedonism pursued to the hilt, but creased with emptiness and weakness. This was The Weeknd's subject. You know, take, for example, one of his popular songs, False Alarm. I don't know if you've ever heard that song before. But the lyrics are, she loves everybody. Can't you tell by the signs? Which this is talking about a woman who is engrossed in soulless materialism and sexual experience. And these signs probably refer to, you know, the jewelry and all of the gifts that she's gotten from different men. She loves everybody. Somebody's head's right there. What does it say? She gets off all the time. Thanks. It's a dark philosophy, and it haunts her constantly. She's a false alarm to me. You know, I've wondered, what does he mean by it's a dark philosophy? What is he referring to? It's probably, you know, the drive, the way of life that she's living. That, you know, life doesn't really matter. It's all about living for material things and sexual experience. You know, also, people no longer see technology as a tool. They view it really as an extension of themselves. For those of us who are a little bit older, you know, who remember a time where the internet didn't exist, when you had dial-up connections. You know, this concept that technology is like part of who you are makes no sense. You know, technology is a tool to be able to accomplish something, to do it quicker. And yet, I think many of the young people that you encounter today view technology really as an extension of themselves. It's funny, when you go to our Epic Summer Camp, which is where high schoolers 700 high schoolers leave to just, you know, go out in the middle of nowhere and listen to Bible teaching. You know, all of them bring their phones on the trip. And it's funny to see some of these students lose their phone. They start freaking out. It's like they're having an existential crisis. And, you know, really everything stops until they can find their phone. In large part because who you are on your social media platform or your online presence is really an aspect of who you are. It's part of your identity. I think it's really interesting to see that different, you know, TV series have captured this. I recently watched Altered Carbon. I don't know if you've ever seen this. This is on Netflix. It's fairly new. But this is set in the future, and in the Altered Carbon world, children are born with what are called cortical stacks, where you can essentially download somebody's personality and their experience onto this cortical stack that you insert into their spinal cord. And in this world, they refer to bodies as sleeves, things that are disposable, because you can essentially take your stack and insert it into another body and continue on. And it's interesting to see the world of the Altered Carbon where, you know, violence is cheap, and really the rich, the ultra wealthy, can experience immortality because they have four or five backup sleeves that they have, and they're constantly uploading their stack to the cloud. And so they're able to take advantage of those who are less wealthy, often having them fight to the death with the promise that they would give them an upgraded sleeve, a new body. And so you see, I think, you know, our culture is picking up on this. There's a sense that, you know, technology is no longer a tool that we use. It's a part of who we are. It's intertwined with our lives. You know, the hollowness of this existential worldview really leaves many feeling the dread of facing a meaningless world. You see this especially when you work with younger people, high school and college age people. You know, today, suicide has overtaken the second spot as the leading cause of death among young people ages 15 to 24. You know, we document the cases where students talk to a leader or talk to somebody about their suicidal ideation. And we've been tracking this, I don't know, for maybe 20-some years. And the number of cases that we've seen just really in the last 5 or 6 years has accelerated. I mean, it's exponentially larger than what we've seen in the past. And I think really it's the underlying worldview that we see in our culture that really nothing matters. Your life contains really no significance. And last of all, I think it reaches theology, where the church, you know, I think without realizing it, unconsciously is gulping down the worldview of our culture. And so I think, in addition to understanding our culture so that we can reach it effectively, I think we need to do this also to guard against cultural accommodation. You know, seeking to understand our culture helps evade cultural accommodation. That seems a little counterintuitive, that in order to protect yourself from the worldview that ultimately could invade the church and cause the church to accommodate theologically, that we need to understand our culture and be engaged. You know, insulating ourselves and our children from culture makes them actually more susceptible to accommodation. You see this all the time with students who are coming from, you know, a Christian background where their parents tried to shield them from culture. And then, you know, when they enter our ministry and we call on them to start reaching out to their friends in class or at work, I mean, there's just a shock. Where, you know, they get confused. Doubts start to crop up in their minds. In large part because they haven't been able to really think about what general culture critically. Also, we need to teach our kids and our disciples how to evaluate culture critically. You know, I think as, you know, we're watching shows together or we're consuming media together, I think it's important to ask the questions. What do you think that means, that commercial? Do you think that Subaru really evokes love? You know, look at this person. They seemed really, really depressed, and they finally got the newest iPhone, and now they're happy. Do you really think that that's true? Or, you know, when we're watching shows, asking questions like, "What? Why do you think this character said this thing?" And so try to get our kids to think about some of these things critically, I think, is very important. And most importantly, I think, bridging the gulf where we're able to connect with our culture. You know, we need to understand our culture if we seek to reach it effectively. It's very important that we really stay on top of contemporary culture. Now, you know, for some of us, that might seem a little daunting. You know, for those of us who are older, we're like, do I really need to subject myself to mumble rap? Is that what you're suggesting? I wouldn't suggest that, okay? But I think many of us have a cultural expert actually living right under our roof. You know, once a year, me and my son, Julius, we go out and we go morel mushroom hunting in a undisclosed area in central Ohio. And, you know, it's really difficult to identify morels and seasoned morel hunters will tell you to do is you need to get really low to the ground. And so, you know, what I do is I essentially get my son to crawl around in the woods to try to find these morels. And there's sort of a joke that, you know, he's going to like turn into my truffle pig that I just send around to go and get my mushrooms. But, you know, I think in the same way, you know, our kids are consuming this stuff, the music, the movies, the TV shows that everybody's watching. And I think it's important for us to engage them and ask, you know, so what do you think this is saying? What do you think it's trying to communicate? Trying to get into their world. You know, what do you think those lyrics are saying? What do you think it tells you about what our culture is saying? And I think for those of us, you know, who are consuming a lot of these songs and the media, I think we need to think critically about what we're consuming. You know, what are these lyrics saying? Asking ourselves these questions, foraging for ways to connect with our culture. Secondly, we should seek to dismantle ideologies under which people take shelter. Francis Schaeffer put it this way: it's unpleasant to be submerged by an avalanche, but we must allow the person to undergo this experience so that he might realize his system has no answer to the crucial questions of life. He must come to know that his roof is really a false protection from the storm. You know, the roof represents a person's worldview. And what Schaeffer suggests is that we need to gently remove the roof by exposing the deficiencies of people's worldviews so that they can realize that there must be a better alternative out there, that they need to come to a point of crisis. But we should do this with compassion. You know, if we just stand back as a critic, we'll come off as anti-cultural, somebody who hates culture, who thinks that it's evil. Instead, we need to approach people and their worldviews with gentleness and compassion, realizing that, you know, at some point we were self-deceived as well. And that the people who shared Christ with us and exposed the deficiencies with our worldview, that in most cases those people were doing it with gentleness and reverence. You know, think about the compassion that Jesus expressed, you know, as he stood over the city of Jerusalem. And he wept over that city which rejected him because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And so I feel like in addition to Schaeffer's sharp critical analysis, one of the great contributions he brought forward was this tone of compassion that we need to bring as we are attempting to to lift the veil over people's eyes. Okay, that's what I had. Lord, we just pray that we can remain relevant. And I really dread the thought that one day we will become out of touch with our culture. Pray that you would help us to adapt to our culture, to understand it, not only to guard against, you know, these worldviews that underlie what drives our culture, but also so that we can reach our culture effectively as we try to find ways to connect with people who are incredibly lost and need you. Pray that in Jesus' name. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.